For this March 24th, this is Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio. I'm Steve Scully. We're glad you're with us. Here are some of your Wednesday headlines. President Biden has put Vice President Kamala Harris in charge of overseeing efforts with Central American countries as a way to try to stem the flow of migrants coming to the U.S. southern border. And a new study from the Texas Public Policy Foundation says a big part of the problem along the southern border is organized crime. We'll get some background on that report just ahead. The Biden administration announcing it will use the San Diego Convention Center as an emergency intake site to house those migrant children. The site will have the capacity to initially accommodate up to 1,400 children, providing them sleeping quarters, meals, and access to medical services. It was at times a contentious hearing as the Senate Rules Committee clashing over a Democratic-sponsored bill aimed at making changes to voting rights and campaign finance laws, as well as potentially new regulations on how states can draw the lines for congressional redistricting. And in Israel, the country continues to count the votes, but right now, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu would not be able to form a government unless he gains the support from the Arab Islamist Ram Party. The Jerusalem Post is reporting that the numbers are based on the results from 97% of the regular polling stations. Just some of the stories shaping Washington today. It's all ahead here on C-SPAN Radio. And we begin at the White House, where the president today announcing he has appointed the Vice President, Kamala Harris, to lead the effort on stemming migration across the U.S.-Mexico border. It comes as the administration facing growing political pressure to address a surge of undocumented migrant children coming to the U.S. without their parents. Now, the president wants the Vice President and her team to lead an effort with Mexico and what's called the Northern Triangle, which is El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras, with two primary goals. Number one, to curb the current flow of migrants. And number two, to look at implementing a long-term strategy that addresses some of the root causes of this migration. The president and the vice president making their comments at the White House earlier today.
So this new surge we're dealing with now started with the last administration, but it's our responsibility to deal with it humanely and to stop what's happening. And so this increase has been consequential. But the vice president's agreed, among the multiple other things that have been meeting, and I appreciate it, agreed to lead our diplomatic effort and work with those nations to accept the returnees and enhance migration enforcement at their borders, at their borders. We're already talking with Mexico about that. She's already done that. We're going to be dealing with a full team now that we have to be able to deal with the problem here at home, but also to deal with it now in terms of in country. And I can think of nobody who's better qualified to do this than a former, this is a woman who ran the second largest attorney general's office in America after the U.S., after the United States Attorney General in the state of California. And has done a great deal of polling in human rights, but also fighting organized crime in the process. So it's not her full responsibility and job, but she's leading the effort, because I think the best thing to do is to put someone who, when he or she speaks, they don't have to wonder about, is that where the president is? When she speaks for me, doesn't have to check with me, she knows what she's doing, and I hope we can move this along. But so, Madam Vice President, thank you. I gave you a tough job, and you're smiling, but there's no one better capable of trying to organize this.
Well, thank you, Mr. President, and for having the confidence in me. And there's no question that this is a challenging situation. As the President has said, there are many factors that lead President to leave these countries. And while we are clear that people should not come to the border now, we also understand that we will enforce the law, and that we also, because we can chew gum and walk at the same time, must address the root causes that that cause people to make the trek, as the President has described, to come here. And I look forward to engaging in diplomacy with government, with private sector, with civil society, and the leaders of each in El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras. To strengthen democracy and the rule of law and ensure shared prosperity in the region. We will collaborate with Mexico and other countries throughout the Western Hemisphere. And as part of this effort, we expect that we will have collaborative relationships to accomplish the goals the president has and that we share. I also look forward to working with members of the Congress who I think share our perspective on the need to address root causes for the migration that we've been seeing. And needless to say, the work will not be easy, but it is important work. It is work that we demand and the people of our countries, I believe, need to help stem the tide that we have seen. So thank you, Mr. President, for your confidence.
A White House meeting earlier today on the immigration issue, those comments by the vice president, and before that, of course, President Biden. Issues that will likely come up tomorrow in the afternoon news conference scheduled for 1:15 Eastern time with the president. Of course, you can listen to it live here on C-SPAN Radio and live on the C-SPAN networks. During his news conference earlier today, South Carolina Republican Senator Lindsey Graham, critical of the way the president has handled the situation, while praising his predecessor, the policies of former President Donald Trump.
President Biden has governed so far after knowing him for so many years, and do you think what's going on at the border right now makes it more likely President Trump might jump in and see an opening again in 2024?
Well, the political implications of letting the border spiral out of control are real for the Democratic Party. This is one of the reasons that President Trump won in 2016. People were frustrated with having a immigration system so easily gained. So President Biden is in denial. I was there almost, 7 or 8 weeks ago now? What did I tell you when I came back? I was a one-man band. This thing is going to blow up in our face. The policy changes are going to lead to a run on the border like you've never seen. When I was there, when did we go? A couple of weeks ago? About mid-February. I came back, and I was talking to anybody that would listen to me. Man, this place is going to deteriorate quickly. You know who told me that? The Border Patrol and customs agents. They're the, God bless them. Can you imagine what it's like to be in charge of 694 children packed in a room meant for 80? Can you imagine the COVID concerns that come from this? I saw it on their face. They'd had control of the border. The Trump policies worked. And to a person, every one of them told me, we're going back to the old way of doing business, but it'd be worse this time. They knew what was coming. And I've been trying to tell people up here, it is coming. Well, I was more right than I thought I would be. And here's the good news. There's a way to fix this. All you have to do, President Biden, you don't have to listen to me. Go to the border yourself. Talk to the people in charge of the port of entries, the Border Patrol, and they will tell you what you need to do to stop this flow. And if you can stop this flow, I will sit down with you and any other Democrat to see if we can deal with the Dreamers. But we can't do that until we stop the flow.
So President Trump, this helps him?
I think it hurts the country. I don't know the political ramifications yet. It depends how this movie ends.
On the issue of the southern border, the Texas Public Policy Foundation has put together a research paper on the role of organized crime and illegal immigration. And the author of that is Josh Jones. He's a senior fellow on border security. So let me begin with this research. What did you find?
Thank you. Just in summary, criminal organizations exist from the Northern Triangle, which is the three countries south of Mexico, Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador, which is where most immigrants originate and begin their journey toward the United States. In that area, it's generally the transnational gangs, which are MS-13 and 18th Street gangs that control that territory. Moving north into Mexico, of course, you have the transnational criminal organizations or the cartels that control territory, and they also profit off of these migrant caravans coming north. So basically, every step of the way from Central America, the Northern Triangle countries, through Mexico and into the United States, you're stepping on ground that's controlled by transnational criminal organizations or gangs. So every step of the way, there's the involvement of organized crime.
And as you point out in your piece, there is a perception that the criminal organizations, especially in Mexico, are there simply to provide guidance. But you write that criminal organizations are involved at every stage of the process. Explain.
Right. Often the motivation to migrate into the United States is the crime, the violence that is caused by the gangs in Central America. And when the migrants encounter the Mexican cartels, the transnational criminal organizations, they are they're taxed as they move north through territories controlled by the cartels. And the cartels also sometimes use them to divert the attention of U.S. law enforcement at the border away from drugs that are being moved, that the cartels are moving into the United States.
So what more should the Biden administration be doing?
I think right now the big thing is messaging. It's not clear. It's not even clear to me right now whether the border is open or not, because they've been saying that they're enforcing the Title II provisions and not allowing adult migrants into the country, and yet there's recent reporting that only 15% of adult migrants are being turned away right now. So I think messaging is important, because when the message coming from the United States is that the borders are open, that Biden's allowing people into the country, then that becomes a talking point of those who in Central America that are controlling these migrant caravans coming north. So they pitch it as the borders, the gates are open in the U.S. So I think messaging is a good start. I think long-term policy should be oriented toward addressing the parts of Central America, the aspects of Central America that cause these migrants to want to come to the United States, which involves the living conditions, the lack of security in those countries, and the lack of jobs, frankly, to support their population.
The essay at the Texas Public Policy Foundation has this headline: joined at the hip, organized crime and illegal immigration. Josh Jones, I guess the obvious follow-up question is how these cartels, how these criminal organizations are able to continue to survive.
They survive because they're protected by governments, particularly in Mexico and Honduras. They have heavy influence over governments, from the local police level all the way up to the presidential level. And there's also corruption issues in El Salvador, Guatemala, and the other countries in Central America. So it's really corruption is sort of the elephant in the room in terms of why we can't really fix this problem.
Josh Jones joining us on the phone from his home in Austin, Texas. Thank you for being with us.
Of course. Thank you.
And now to Capitol Hill, where the Senate Democratic leader critical of a number of new bills being offered by Republicans that he says would place limits on the ability to vote. Meanwhile, Democrats taking up their own election reform bill in the Senate. In a hearing before the Rules Committee, Senator Chuck Schumer of New York saying Republicans are trying to, quote, disenfranchise voters after losing in the 2020 election.
There is a concerted nationwide effort to limit the right of American citizens to vote and to truly have a voice in their own government. In the wake of the November elections, one of the safest in recent history, Republican-led state legislatures have seized on the former president's big lie that the election was stolen and introduced more than 250 bills in 43 states aimed at tightening voting rules under the guise of election integrity. Instead of doing what you should be doing when you lose an election in a democracy, attempting to win over those voters in the next election, Republicans instead are trying to disenfranchise those voters. Shame on them. In Iowa, where college students often rely on the flexibility provided by early and mail-in voting, the Republican legislature voted to cut early voting by 9 days, close polls an hour earlier, and tighten rules on absentee voting. In Wisconsin, where urban and rural precincts face vastly different administrative burdens, Republicans have proposed limiting ballot drop boxes to only one municipality, no matter what its size. Could be 10,000 voters in a rural Republican county, or 500,000 voters in an urban Democratic voter county, one ballot drop box. In Arizona, no fewer than 22 separate measures to limit voting rights have been introduced, including a bill to require every absentee ballot to be notarized. How are poor people going to pay for a notary when there's virtually no indication of fraud? It's one of the most despicable things I have seen in all my years. Shame, shame, shame.
Meanwhile, the Brennan Center for Justice found that as of mid-February, Republicans in those 43 states that Senator Schumer referred to had proposed more than 250 bills that would make it harder to vote, including proposing changes to mail-in voting or the voter ID requirements that Senator Schumer also referred to earlier today. And a Washington Post analysis found that the changes could amount to the biggest shift in access to the ballot since Reconstruction, placing limits on the ability to vote for tens of millions of Americans. That analysis piece is available at WashingtonPost.com. And an op-ed also in the Post, Maine's independent Senator Angus King saying that he would support changing the Senate rules if Republicans block the voting rights legislation. Now, Senator King does caucus with the Democrats, and in the past he's expressed some concerns over changes to the filibuster. But today he wrote the following, quote, "All-out opposition to reasonable voting rights protections cannot be enabled by the filibuster. If forced to choose between a Senate rule and democracy itself, I know where I will come down." He went on to call this issue, quote, "a special case." You can also read that at WashingtonPost.com, the view of Senator Angus King of Maine. But the Senate Republican leader, Mitch McConnell, saying that the Democratic plan to reform voting laws is nothing more than a power grab. He says it is an invitation to chaos. He also testified before the Senate Rules Committee.
States are not engaging in trying to suppress voters whatsoever. This is clearly an effort by one party to rewrite the rules of our political system. But even more immediately, it would create an implementation nightmare, as Senator Blunt pointed out, that would drown state and local officials who run elections. This proposal needs all the scrutiny it can get, and I'm glad we're all here to give it that scrutiny. This legislation would forcibly rewrite the election laws of all 50 states from here in Washington. Popular policies like voter ID requirements would be banned unless states neutered them with loopholes. Meanwhile, unpopular and absurd practices like ballot harvesting, where paid political operatives can show up carrying stacks of other people's ballots, would not just be allowed, it would be mandatory. Washington would mandate that every state and county in America adopt same-day voter registration with minimal safeguards. But it would make it incredibly difficult for states and counties to conduct routine voter list maintenance, like removing dead people or voters who don't live there any longer. Then there's the whole question of political speech. Refereeing campaigns and policing speech are sensitive tasks. Appropriately, the FEC was designed after Watergate to be bipartisan, an even split, 3-3. So let me dwell on that for a minute. After Watergate, my party, the Republican Party, was just about wiped out. The overwhelming Democratic majorities could have done anything they wanted to. It never occurred to them that the Federal Election Commission, set up to police how we run campaigns, would be made a partisan entity. They could have done it then. Now we're in a 50-50 Senate and a narrowly majority in the House, and this audacious move wants to turn the judge of our democratic process into a partisan prosecutor. Talk about shame.
Testimony before the Senate Rules Committee and the comments of Republican leader Mitch McConnell on the bill S-1. Democrats are calling it the, quote, "For the People Act." And the committee chair, Senator Amy Klobuchar of Minnesota, saying that the legislation would make voting easier and would get big money out of politics. As mentioned, a similar bill did pass the House by a vote of 220-210. It did not receive a single Republican vote. Also, news with Senator McConnell during an interview on Fox News earlier today. The Republican leader saying he has yet to speak to the president or meet with him in person since Joe Biden was sworn in as the 46th president.
When will you be at the White House? When have you been invited to meet President Biden?
I haven't been invited to the White House. So far, this administration is not interested in doing anything on a bipartisan basis in the political center. They'd be more than happy to pick off a few of our members and do what they would like to do. But there's been no efforts whatsoever by the president or the administration to do anything in the political center.
Let me try
again
here.
It's been trying to jam through everything on the hard left. You saw that on the $1.9 trillion COVID package, only 1% of which had to do with vaccines and only 9% of which had to do with health care. The rest of it was a left-wing wish list. They're now cooking up yet another package they're going to call infrastructure, but it's going to be a Trojan horse that includes massive tax increases on Americans. They're going hard left. They misread the election. It's a 50-50 Senate and a very narrow Democratic majority in the House. Not a mandate to turn America into Bernie Sanders' view of what America ought to be.
When was the last time you had a conversation with President Biden, even on the phone?
I don't believe I've spoken with him since he was sworn in. We had a couple of conversations before then.
Those comments from the Senate Republican leader, Mitch McConnell. He was on Fox News earlier today with Bill Hemmer asking the questions. And at today's White House briefing, a follow-up, this question to Press Secretary Jen Psaki.
And I wanted to ask, Leader McConnell has said that he hasn't been invited to the White House and he hasn't had a direct conversation with the president since the inauguration.
I think he corrected that statement.
Mm-hmm. I was curious, because I know previously Leader McCarthy had said that he had tried to reach out to the White House to get an invitation here. Does the president plan to have some sort of big, you know, meeting with leaders from across the aisle where we would see photos of them together and things like that?
I'm sure he will. We obviously have been limited on COVID to any events in the East Wing, and at this point we'd be very much in the Easter egg roll preparations, which of course we will not be, but obviously more important, substantive, vital meetings than that. He's had a number of meetings, bipartisan meetings in the Oval Office. He will continue to do those. Those have often been constructed with committee chairs or members with specific jurisdiction. He has a long friendship with Leader McConnell. He has spoken with him. He speaks with him regularly. We're obviously not going to read out all of those calls. I expect that will continue.
That's from today's White House briefing with Press Secretary Jen Psaki. Within a week, 8 people killed in Atlanta, 10 gunned down on Monday in Boulder, Colorado, and in a CBS News interview this morning, Vice President Kamala Harris calling on the Senate to pass the House-approved gun bill. Now, that legislation would expand background checks for gun sales. As we pointed out yesterday, a Senate hearing showed little Republican support for the measure. Senator Ted Cruz calling the hearing, quote, ridiculous theater. And the vice president saying if Congress does not act, then President Biden will likely move ahead by signing a series of executive orders. More from the interview this morning on CBS.
What will the Biden administration do? We keep hearing about executive action. What does that mean, Madam Vice President?
What it means is that we need to take action. But Gail, let's be clear about this. There is the piece about executive action, but if we pass legislation, it's permanent. If the Congress acts, then it becomes law. And that is what we have lacked. That is what has been missing. We need universal background checks. You know, various states have done it. But there's no universal approach to this. And so what ends up happening, people can move from one state to another depending on what the law is. We need to have a federal standard, and that is going to be accomplished by the way we have structured our democracy when the United States Congress acts. The House has acted. Now it's in the hands of the Senate, President is prepared to sign it.
But, Madam Vice President, as it stands right now, you do not have the votes. Failing that, is the president prepared to take executive action?
We should first expect the United States Congress to act. I'm not willing to give up on what we must do to appeal to the hearts and minds and the reason of the members of the United States Senate. I served in that body, and I believe that it is possible, it has to be possible, that people agree that these slaughters have to stop. And this is, again, reject the false choice and stop pushing it for sure. Stop pushing the false choice that this means everybody's trying to come after your guns. That is not what we're talking about.
The full interview with Vice President Kamala Harris, it's available online at cbsnews.com. And we are getting more information on how the events unfolded Monday afternoon during those early moments inside the King Soopers grocery store. 10 people died. The suspect remains in custody. Courtesy of CNN.com, this is what it sounded like in those first moments.
He went in the store.
Right down there.
Oh, my God. Guys, we got people down inside King Soopers. Look, there's... Holy s***.
Suspect in the building. This is the Boulder Police Department. The entire building is surrounded. I need you to surrender now.
I just looked at my son and I told him, we have 3 seconds. Stay low and don't look and just move fast.
At first I heard like a loud bang, so I kind of thought like a shelf fell over or something like that. But then immediately when I heard multiple gunshots, I knew that it was something more than that.
I didn't see a shooter. I just saw terrified faces running towards me. And that's when I turned and ran in the other direction.
I initially heard maybe 10 gunshots. I also saw the gunman himself holding a semi-automatic rifle. And a few seconds later, I saw people running out of the building. I heard screaming.
Those first 10 accounts, courtesy of CNN News, that 21-year-old gunman accused of killing those 10 people at the supermarket in Boulder. He is now scheduled to make his first court appearance. That will take place tomorrow. His family saying that over the weekend, he was playing with a machine gun and just last week purchased a high-powered pistol. We're also learning more about the victims, a 51-year-old police officer from Boulder, the father of 7, Eric Talley. Ricky Olds, described as a 25-year-old strong and independent young lady who worked as the front-end store manager, and 2 other employees from the store. Denny Strong was 20 years old. Terry Leiker was 51. And then there was Kevin Mahoney. He recently saw his daughter get married, was set to become a grandfather. He was 61. And Suzanne Fountain, a 59-year-old financial counselor in the healthcare industry. She was also a local theater buff. She had performed in a number of productions in Boulder and in Denver. Her friend Martha Pardee spoke about Suzanne Fountain this morning during a CNN interview.
I was just listening to the other tributes, and they're just so beautiful and moving. We met on stage doing a show and quickly discovered that we were just a week apart and in age, and she never let me forget that I was the older one. Oddly enough, we were playing a character that was split into 2 parts, an older and a younger, and of course I played the older. We also quickly established that we'd both been born in New Jersey, even though we met in Denver. I loved her immediately. I think that's just what happened when people met her. She was a bright light, a peace lover, a strong feminist. She has the most incredible son that she raised, imbuing him with the kinds of values that I hope all our young men these days carry with them. That's a tribute to her. She just had so many friends and kept them. We were friends for over 30 years. She was authentic, down to earth, a lovely hostess. Boy, did you eat and drink well when you went to her house. A beautiful actress. It was a joy and an honor to work with her on stage because she was so connected and so present and so generous. Generosity just was in her cells. She imbued everything she did.
Tell us a little bit about that, because, you know, that's clearly a big part of your relationship with her. She was very active in the Denver theater community, and she even won some awards.
Yeah, she sure did, and rightfully so. Again, I just have to reiterate, it was her authenticity and her generosity as a person that it carried through onto the stage. And, you know, I think that's the sort of the highest praise you can give to an actor is that they're authentic and generous on stage to watch and to work with. And she wasn't self-centered. She wasn't self-serving. She was always part of the team. She boosted people up. She brought light into any situation. And she was really good, too. I mean, you know, all that and superior talent. She studied at Circle in the Square in New York. And we got to act together twice. But I never missed a show she was in because I loved to watch her on stage. I always learned something.
That's from Martha Harmon Pardee on her friend Suzanne Fountain, the interview earlier today on CNN. The Denver Center for the Performing Arts writing on Twitter, "We are heartbroken by the senseless violence in Boulder and saddened to learn about the death of actress Suzanne Fountain." By the way, the Boulder community holding a vigil tonight to honor the 10 victims from Monday's shooting. You're listening to Washington Today. And welcome back. You're listening to Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio. Here are some of your other headlines. West Virginia Senator Joe Manchin saying that he would support a $3 trillion plan to upgrade America's roads and bridges and rail lines, part of an infrastructure plan, but he says Democrats need to pay for it by raising taxes on corporations. And Virginia officially becoming the first southern state and the 23rd state nationwide to end capital punishment. Governor Ralph Northam signing legislation that would abolish the death penalty. Since its days as a colony and later a state, Virginia has executed an estimated 1,400 people. And during the 19th century, many died through hangings and later through electrocution. The CDC announcing today it remains worried about the stall in what has been a national decline of COVID-19 cases. The U.S. has surpassed 30 million infections. The death toll in this country, 546,000. Based on the most recent seven-day trends, the national average is nearly 55,000 new cases in our country every day. And Dr. Rochelle Walensky saying that is a 3% rise in just 1 week, part of what we learned in today's briefing.
Yes, I am normally guarded. I remain guarded. Indeed, I'm enthusiastic about the pace at vaccination that is happening, about the early data that we're seeing, the changes in infection rates, the changes in emergency department rates. What worries me is that while we have, you know, about 24% of the population who has received one dose and about 13% of the population that is fully vaccinated, what concerns me is the footage of what's happening in spring breakers, in people who are not continuing to implement prevention strategies while we get fully scaled up. We're at 13%. We need to be much higher than that to feel like we have adequate protection around this country. So the early data are really encouraging, and that's why I'm so I emphasize how we need to hang in there for just a little while longer, because we can see a time in the next couple of months where we will have a lot more people vaccinated and we will really be able to blunt infection rates. We're still hanging out at 55,000 cases a day, and we're watching what's happening in people who are vacationing right now, and that concerns me a lot.
Yeah, just to underscore what Dr. Walensky said, when I'm often asked, are we turning the corner? My response is really more like we are at the corner. Whether or not we're going to be turning that corner still remains to be seen, depending upon what Dr. Walensky said, not to repeat it. We do have a lot of challenges in front of us with regard to the high level of daily infections, yesterday being 54,974. When you're at that level, I don't think you can declare victory and say you've turned the corner. You've got to continue to do what we're doing, more vaccinations, and continue to do public health measures until we actually do turn the corner.
And that assessment from Dr. Anthony Fauci, joined by the CDC Director Rochelle Walensky, and the comments come as more states are beginning to ease restrictions. You heard reference to spring break, especially in Miami Beach, where there is a lockdown. But earlier today, Indiana announcing that the state's mask restriction will be eliminated beginning on April the 6th. The vaccine effort continues. According to NIH, more than 25% of all Americans have received at least one of the vaccine shots. That number is at 70% for Americans over the age of 65. Also at the White House today, the president's senior advisor to the COVID response, Andy Slavitt, saying schools are beginning to reopen and the federal government will provide more assistance that they need to get kids back into the classroom.
Today, at the Department of Education's National Safe School Reopening Summit, President Biden will announce that $81 billion in American Rescue Plan funds will be made available to all 50 states, D.C., and Puerto Rico to support their efforts to safely return to in-person instruction as expeditiously as possible this spring and meet the needs of all students. This announcement builds on our ongoing efforts to support schools and staff by investing in testing and prioritizing teachers for vaccination. Together, these steps will help return more kids back to the classroom sooner, ensure equity, and keep us on track to meet the president's goal for school reopenings in his first 100 days.
And that from Andy Slavitt, who is the president's senior advisor on COVID-19, a position he will keep until June, when it was reported earlier this month he will step down. And in remarks earlier this month, the Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen saying that the COVID-19 pandemic has been, quote, extremely unfair on the income and economic opportunities of women. And she's calling for long-term steps to improve the labor market conditions. The issue came up in a hearing today before the Senate Banking Committee, the second day of two hearings for the Treasury Secretary and the Fed Chair. Today is known as Equal Pay Day. This date, March 24th, symbolizes how far into the year women must work to earn what men earn in the previous year. The questioning from Senator Tina Smith to the Treasury Secretary.
I want to just hone in on the issue of women in the workplace. And, you know, you and I have spoken about this, the challenges that women are facing in the workplace right now. COVID has made it so much worse. Women dropping out of the workforce at roughly the same rates as men. But now what's happening is men are returning to the workforce and women are not. In Minnesota, it's an 11% decline in women's participation in the workforce. And one of the two major, there's two basic issues that women face. One is lack of access to affordable child care, and the other is lack of access to paid family leave. And this is happening in the United States at different ways than it's happening in Europe, as I understand it. So, as part of the American Rescue Plan, as you well know, I worked with Senator Warren and others to make a significant investment in shoring up our childcare system.
Yes.
Secretary Yellen, I was wondering if you could just talk a bit about this. How does this ability of women to participate in the workforce connect to our economic competitiveness, and what role does childcare play in making sure that women can participate in the workforce and support their families?
Well, I think that women have contributed enormously in the United States and in countries around the world. Their labor force participation has boosted growth and has boosted household incomes. And we saw a surge in women's labor force participation in the 1970s and 80s, but it's leveled off and it's even declined somewhat. And there are a number of reasons for it, but when you look at the fact that in many European countries and other developed countries, labor force participation of women is now higher than it is in the United States, what stands out is paid leave and affordable child care as two things that distinguish the United States from those countries. They're really critical to enabling women to successfully participate. And I think it's exciting that the American Rescue Plan really addresses these issues, providing additional, very meaningful support on both fronts.
Just one of the exchanges before the Senate Banking Committee with the Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen and questions from Minnesota Democratic Senator Tina Smith. Also on Capitol Hill today, the Fed Chair Jerome Powell yesterday on the House side, and all of the hearings available on our website at cspan.org. You're listening to Washington Today. Joining us from London with more on the U.S. economy, Joe Wallace. He is a markets reporter for The Wall Street Journal. And I want to begin with the testimony yesterday and today by the Fed Chair and the Treasury Secretary, because a recurring series of questions focusing on inflation. Why are there concerns?
So I think there are two main reasons why some economists and also investors are worried about inflation. We've seen those worries feed into higher bond yields in recent weeks. The first reason is that we've obviously seen this huge stimulus package being passed, the $1.9 trillion relief package. And even some left-wing economists think that this is going to add a lot of stimulus to an economy that's already in pretty good health, and that will boost demand for goods and services and lead to a faster rate of consumer price growth. The second factor is a short-term factor. We saw prices for a lot of raw materials, including energy, really slumped this time last year. as the pandemic started to hit the world economy, prices for lots of raw materials are now rising at a pretty rapid pace, especially in comparison to where we were a year ago. So that will lead to that will automatically boost inflation in the coming months. And then kind of adding to that, there's another wrinkle, which is that we're seeing disruption in a lot of supply chains, both for commodities and also some other goods such as chips and plastics following the freeze in Texas. And some of these supply chain issues. And also today, you know, the tankers, so the container ships stuck in the Suez Canal, a vital artery for international trade, which could lead to some short-term kind of pockets of shortages of certain goods and materials. So taken together, this is why there are some concerns out there about inflation coming back.
Are you hearing and seeing those same concerns across Great Britain and throughout Europe?
To a degree, but to a lesser extent. You know, the same worries about shortages of some raw materials and rising commodity prices are present. What we don't have here yet is the prospect of such a big economic stimulus package in comparison to the $1.9 trillion package in the US. So, in the UK, even the government is hinting at raising some taxes, which could put a lid on some of those inflation fears.
And, of course, the story that you posted earlier today on the Wall Street Journal website, and we're seeing this across the country, the average price of a gallon of gas approaching $3, and it is expected to continue to rise through the summer. Why?
Yes, as you say, you know, prices approaching $3 a gallon on average across the country. In many states, most notably California and also in Washington, prices are already above $3 a gallon. So far, this really reflects a big drop in the amount of gasoline that's in storage in the U.S., which is itself the result both of the big winter freeze that hit Texas in February and knocked a lot of big petroleum refiners out of action for a while. That disruption continues. That meant that less gasoline was being produced. And then also refiners had already really dialed down the amount of road fuel they were producing last year in response to the pandemic, to the slump in energy prices, which meant it was unprofitable in some instances to produce gasoline. So all those factors have combined to create almost a shortfall of gasoline. Gasoline inventories are well below their normal level for this time of year.
And based on your reporting, it looks as if prices will continue to rise into the summer.
Yeah, so demand remains below its 2019 levels for this time of year, but there's the expectation that drivers will hit the roads as the vaccines become, distributed across the country. If coronavirus cases continue to decline, there might be a lot of Americans who want to get out on the road, especially in the summer driving season, which will lead to a pick up in demand. And to some degree, that expectation is already feeding into the price. The price is rising to encourage refiners to produce more gasoline so that there's enough in supply to meet that summer jump in demand. There is a caveat, which is that commuting accounts for a big chunk of gasoline demand in the US. And of course, a lot of Americans continue to either work from home or obviously millions of Americans are unemployed. So that will likely reduce the amount of gasoline being used by commuters, which could keep a lid on prices and on demand.
Joe Wallace, he is a markets reporter for The Wall Street Journal and joining us this evening from London. We appreciate your time.
Thanks very much.
At the closing bell on Wall Street, the Dow off by just 3 points. The loss is much more significant for the tech-heavy Nasdaq, shedding 265 points, and the S&P losing 21 and a third. In London and elsewhere across parts of Great Britain, the protests continue in response to the lockdown restrictions. The measures have been in place since early January, after the country saw a surge in infection rates. More recently, Prime Minister Boris Johnson easing some of those restrictions, but the frustrations became apparent today in the House of Commons. From Prime Minister's Questions, here is Ed Davey. He is a Liberal Democratic Member of Parliament.
The Prime Minister talks about restoring freedoms as we emerge from the lockdown. It is pushing a bill that will restrict one of our most fundamental freedoms, the right to peaceful protest and peaceful assembly. And tomorrow, he is asking for another blank check to restrict everyone's freedoms until September, even though we now know the vast bulk of the Coronavirus Act is not needed to tackle the pandemic. So will the Prime Minister, for once, match his actions to his words, drop these draconian laws, and instead publish a roadmap to revive civil liberties and freedoms in our country?
I sympathise very much with his desire to see freedoms restored. And I want to do that as fast as we possibly can. That's why we've set out the cautious but we hope irreversible roadmap that we have, which I hope that he supports. I hope the Right Honourable Gentleman also supports, so you can never tell, Mr. Speaker. But what we also want to do is to make sure that we're able to deal with the very considerable backlog that we've faced because of the pandemic. So making sure that we have powers still to accelerate court procedures with Zoom courts, to make sure that we allow volunteers to continue to help in the NHS, retired staff to come back to the colours, powers that are necessary in education. It is important to be able to continue with those special measures for the months ahead. And that's why we've set out the bill as we have.
From Question Time earlier today in London with Prime Minister Boris Johnson, we carry it live every Wednesday morning on C-SPAN 2. And a reminder, this program, it's available as a podcast. Be sure to subscribe to Washington Today so you never miss an episode. Follow us on Twitter at C-SPAN Radio. I'm Steve Scully with a Wednesday edition, hoping you enjoy the rest of your evening.